From Feature Story News in Washington, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On the programme today, the British politicians waging a last-ditch fight to stop voters in Scotland from declaring independence.
Well, I'll do everything that I can, and let's be frank, there's a lot that the political leaders disagree about, but there's one thing we all agree about passionately, and that is that our United Kingdom is better off if we stay together.
David Cameron's job may hinge on the outcome of next week's referendum. We'll talk to FSN's London Bureau Chief, Ollie Barrett, about the campaign, and to FSN's New York Bureau Chief, Nick Harper, about whether the United Nations is ready to accept a new member. That's all ahead on today's FSN Reports after our summary of the main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. In Syria, a suicide bomb attack has killed at least 20 people attending a top meeting of the rebel group Ahrar al-Sham. It's reported that the group's leader, Hassan Abood, is among the dead. The Ahrar al-Sham group is a key member of the Islamic Front Alliance, formed to combat Islamic State militants, otherwise known as ISIS or ISIL. Meanwhile, U.S. President Barack Obama is meeting with Republican and Democratic leaders as he tries to persuade Congress to back his plan to deal with the Islamic State group. Mr. Obama is set to announce his plans in a speech on Wednesday, as a new poll shows Americans widely support airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. Lorna Shattuck reports from Washington.
Barack Obama is spending Tuesday conferring with congressional leaders from both parties in an attempt to get their support for a planned offensive against the Islamic State. The White House is keen to ensure lawmakers are fully behind the policy and bear joint responsibility, whether or not they're asked to vote on it. The strategy is expected to involve an expansion of the airstrikes in Iraq that began in August, but the president's also likely to discuss putting together a coalition of international allies to oppose the militants. It comes as a new poll for ABC News and The Washington Post shows that more than 90% of Americans see the Islamic State as a serious threat to U.S. interests.
Dutch experts investigating the downing of flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine say it was hit by numerous objects that pierced the plane at high speed. All 298 people died on board the flight from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur on July 17th when it broke apart in midair. Our Europe correspondent Jack Perak reports.
The Dutch Safety Board has released a report which says there is no evidence of technical or human error, and that the plane broke apart due to structural damage caused by a number of large objects penetrating it from outside. Many Western leaders blame pro-Russian rebels for shooting the plane down with a Buk anti-aircraft system. Moscow continues to deny it has supplied any such weaponry to those fighting in eastern Ukraine.
A great history discovery out of Canada, Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced that a British explorer ship that disappeared more than a century and a half ago in the Arctic has been found. The ship was part of a famed expedition by Sir John Franklin, who set out in 1845 to map the Northwest Passage, but vanished along the way, creating a great mystery. Prime Minister Harper said it's not yet clear which one of Sir Franklin's two ships has been discovered. Tech giant Apple has announced its newest slate of products, including the iPhone 6 and a long-rumored iWatch. Apple is venturing into new territory with the unveiling of its smartwatch, which can sync with users' iPhones, play apps, and track the user's health and exercise. The new iPhone is its thinnest yet and features a larger screen. Apple also announced a new payment system called Apple Pay, which it says can replace the wallet. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Formula One athlete Michael Schumacher will leave a Swiss hospital to continue his rehab from a severe head injury at home. The seven-time racing champion was injured in a skiing accident last December. Ira Spitzer reports from Berlin.
Nearly 9 months after his injury, the German racing legend is returning to his home in Gland, Switzerland. He spent six of those months in a medically induced coma after undergoing two operations to remove life-threatening blood clots. Schumacher fell and hit his head on a rock while skiing in the French Alps. Schumacher's manager announced the news in a statement in which he asked that the Schumacher family's privacy be respected and saying that there was still a long and difficult road ahead in his rehabilitation.
And the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere has accelerated at the fastest pace in 30 years, according to the World Meteorological Organization. The UN group's figures are considered the most accurate, and the recorded levels for 2013 are intensifying fears of an acceleration in global warming. Daniel Wrenches has this report.
The levels of carbon dioxide, or CO2, in the atmosphere in 2013 reached 396 parts per million, an increase of 2.9 parts on 2012, the largest increase since 1984. Concentrations of many other heat-trapping gases, including methane, also sharply increased, alarming scientists who point to a rapid and irreversible acceleration in global warming impacts. The World Meteorological Organization's report says the oceans are responsible for absorbing many of these gases, which in turn makes them more acidic, bringing further critical environmental impacts such as diminishing the ability of coral and many other sea creatures to reproduce.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
And this is the day that the No campaign finally fell apart at the seams. We now know, after all of the hype of the last 48 hours since they realised that the ground was shifting under their feet, there's actually nothing new in this package whatsoever. This is a retreading, a repackaging, a retimetabling of what they said in the spring.
Alex Salmond, Scotland's First Minister, speaking to reporters after the latest opinion polls suggested the people of Scotland may be on the brink of voting in favour of independence from the rest of Britain. The referendum is on September the 18th, and today the leaders of all Britain's major political parties headed to Scotland in what's being seen as a last-ditch bid to persuade Scots not to go it alone. Today on the programme, we're going to look at what's at stake in the Scottish referendum with FSN's London Bureau Chief, Ollie Barrett, who is with me now. Also here in the studio, our New York Bureau Chief, Nick Harper. He's preparing to cover the upcoming UN General Assembly, and we'll talk about that in a few moments. But first, Ollie, let's talk about Scotland. And you saw today the leaders of the three major political parties, including Prime Minister David Cameron, abandon their activities in London and head to Scotland in what many seem to think is a sign of panic among the British political establishment in London that the Scots may indeed be about to do something that a few weeks ago seemed unthinkable.
Yeah, the polls have narrowed significantly in recent days, and I think that absolutely has really worried people in Westminster. I mean, David Cameron does not want to be the Prime Minister under whose watch the United Kingdom ceased to exist. I guess it's a crucial part of your job description as Prime Minister of a country to keep that country together. The difficulty for him, and actually for the other two leaders of the two main parties, is that they're not desperately popular in Scotland. And so David Cameron, throughout this campaign, has had this difficult balance to strike where he's wanted to campaign to keep the United Kingdom together, to keep Scotland part of the Union, but he's been quite reluctant really to do too much north of the border in Scotland and to say too much in Scotland, because there's been some concern that actually him campaigning may harm the campaign. And so you've seen some reasonably high-profile Scottish figures taking the lead for the No campaign. But now, yeah, I mean, I think panic is a fair enough way to describe it, heading north to try and paint a more positive picture now of why the Westminster parties want to keep Scotland as part of the United Kingdom.
But it's terribly late in the day for that, isn't it? I mean, I just saw a picture of the Scottish flag being hoisted above number 10 Downing Street in London today. You've got the British political establishment now saying to Scots, in the aftermath of that poll being published, well, maybe we could really talk about some serious federal autonomy here, as opposed to what many Scots argue are the relatively limited measures that Scotland has enjoyed over the last few years. I mean, isn't this going to be seen inevitably by many people in Scotland as too little, too late?
I think it will by many, and it is being seen by many in Scotland as a sign of the arrogance of what they see as a Westminster elite, that they haven't felt until now that it's been worth doing something like this, worth taking measures like cancelling Prime Minister's questions and travelling north to campaign to keep the United Kingdom together. It will absolutely be seen as a sign of desperation, too little, too late by many. On the other hand, there will be many Scots who I think have been crying out for some time for a more forthright display of positivity about the union. There's been a lot of criticism of the No campaign, the people who want to Scotland not to, to vote for independence. There's been a lot of criticism that they've been too negative. It's all been about, if you go it alone, Scotland, this will happen. You'll, you know, your currency won't work. The European Union will be a disaster for you, and so on and so forth. And a lot of Scots have been wanting to hear a more positive message, you know, why we all love each other and want to stay together.
Well, they certainly weren't hearing a more positive message if they read Paul Krugman's column in the New York Times yesterday. He told Scots that they should be afraid, be very afraid of the prospect of independence. President Obama, who hasn't directly waded in on the issue, I mean, he hasn't told Scots to vote no, but he made it pretty clear when he was in Britain just a few weeks ago that he thought the concept of a unified United Kingdom had actually served the country rather well. So he clearly doesn't relish the idea of having to deal with a separate Scottish government. Is there any indication that these sort of international pleas that are being made to the people of Scotland not to do this are in any way altering opinion, either in favour or against?
I don't think there is much evidence of that. And, you know, in fact, if you're a proud Scot and people keep telling you why your country will fall apart if you go it alone, you know, I think many proud Scots are more inclined, in the face of those warnings, you might even see them as threats, to prove that they can survive as an independent country. I think that there's no doubt that Scotland would be okay as an independent country, but, you know, the Westminster politicians have been trying to insert some doubt into people's minds, things like currency, things like the European Union, what would happen to Scotland's membership of that, what would happen to the monarchy, to the royal family, and so on. But there has been no evidence, really, that any interventions from Barack Obama, certainly not from Mr. Krugman, have made much of an impact on the Scottish voting public.
Can I pick up on that issue of the royal family? Because Alex Salmond, Scotland's First Minister, we heard from him at the start of the programme, met Queen Elizabeth II at Balmoral Castle. Says that he won't discuss the content of their private discussions, but indicated that he believed that she could continue serving as the Queen of an independent Scotland. How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question, and it's a point like this you start to wonder maybe what the point of independence is.
And how much of it has been thought through.
Exactly. Because if essentially, in many ways, the status quo will be maintained, then what is the difference? And what is the difference for an independent Scotland that keeps the same head of state, keeps the same monarch? You know, the Queen does perform that role for countries other than the United Kingdom. She's obviously the head of the Commonwealth as well. So she's well used to serving in many different ways for different parts of the world. But it's an odd one. And you're, as you mentioned earlier, we're getting to the point where Westminster parties are also now offering more devolution to the Scottish Parliament, more powers to the Scottish politicians. So we're almost getting to a stage where an independent Scotland or a Scotland that stays in the Union begin to look actually pretty similar.
So what happens if we all wake up, you're going to be in Edinburgh as the votes are counted, we all wake up on September the 19th and discover that Scotland has indeed gone it alone. That then sparks what? A series of negotiations on all of these issues? NATO membership, EU membership? What does the border look like between England and Scotland? And how quickly do decisions have to get made?
Exactly. All of these things would then need to be negotiated. Now, I mean, there have been sort of different levels of contingency planning and different levels of what people have been admitting they've been planning for in terms of contingencies when it comes to the border, when it comes to the European Union. But all of these things essentially would have to be negotiated over the course of 6 months to a year or so, 18 months maybe. But there are some things which are easier to settle, like the border. You know, you would expect that they're not going to suddenly put up a wall and stop Englishmen and women travelling to Scotland.
The Emperor Hadrian
exactly.
Has tried that.
Yes, yeah, exactly. That's not going to happen. Things like that, they can settle pretty easily. But things like Britain's nuclear deterrent, which is currently housed in Scotland, that is much more complicated. I mean, that would take years to move. And things like that, it's not entirely clear at this stage exactly what happens to them.
And you think this has been on both sides, the Yes campaign and the No campaign? I mean, given that until a few weeks ago, it seemed likely that the No campaign was going to triumph, that this was an expression of will and an aspirational expression on the part of the Yes campaign. Now, they're looking actually at the prospect of victory. By all accounts, privately, they are as surprised as anybody else by this. Do you think that either on the No side or the Yes side, many of these details have really been thought out ahead of time, or are we going to wake up and discover that everybody's throwing cards into the air, including, as you mentioned on yesterday's programme, the possibility of David Cameron having to resign?
Yeah, I think, you know, all of these things have been thought about by both sides, but none of these things can be properly planned in a hypothetical sense. You know, you can't realistically set out what will happen to every part of the relationship between the United Kingdom and Scotland in hypothetical terms. Much of it will have to happen come the vote and come the result. And if Scotland were to become independent, you know, it's unlikely that there's ever any going back. But on the other side of the coin, the fact that the race has now got much closer, I think, raises the prospect of what people are calling a neverendum, where, you know, Scotland can vote to stay in the union, but only just, and then we'll be back in the same place in 5 years' time with another referendum being called for by the Scottish Nationalist Party. So if it is very close, you know, this doesn't end the story of Scottish independence.
So Nick Harper, who covers events at the United Nations and in New York for Feature Story News, what are they doing at the United Nations? Are they preparing to welcome Scotland as perhaps the UN's next full member?
At this stage, there doesn't seem to be any full-scale preparations underway, but that's something that they could turn around quite quickly. At the moment, they've got 193 different member states, countries that are involved in the United Nations. It'll be very interesting to see whether we're about to add another to that number, taking it up to 194, which would mean creating nameplates, creating office space, working out who would be the permanent representative at the United Nations for Scotland. At this stage, they are lumped in with the United Nations, United Kingdom's representative. But I think in some respects, it would be something of a game changer for Scotland at the United Nations. At the moment, the United Kingdom is one of the permanent five members on the UN Security Council. They have a permanent seat at the table. They're permanently represented by the UK ambassador. By going it alone, by breaking out and becoming their own country, they no longer have that permanent seat at the table. They could apply for one of the 10 rotating seats on the United Nations Security Council, but those don't come up very often, every couple of years. So the prospect of Scotland having some sort of representation on the Security Council would be something that may come every couple of decades or so.
Presumably there are procedures in place for this kind of thing. I mean, you've added South Sudan as a member, you added East Timor as a member. I mean, presumably there's a series of fairly well understood procedures for allowing another country to come and join the rest.
Yes, I mean, obviously it has to come initially with an application, as it were, from the country to say that they are interested in joining. And from there is a lot of paperwork. But it is something that can be turned around fairly quickly. South Sudan's independence just over 3 years ago, they were the most recent country or member state to be added to the United Nations. And that happened really rather quickly. They, before we knew it, had working areas, office space. They had a representative there. So it could be that in a year's time from now, we're preparing for this year's United Nations General Assembly. But in 12 months from now, we could have someone from Scotland turning up to the UN General Assembly to speak on issues that they feel are important.
And Ollie, looking at that, the precedent, for example, South Sudan, I mean, when it became the newest member of the United Nations, people said it could never be economically viable as a country on its own. And those predictions in many ways now seem very prescient. There are those who say Scotland cannot be economically viable on its own, and indeed that if the Yes campaign triumphs, there is going to be immediately substantial capital flight out of the country. Is that, in from what you've seen, a likely outcome of a Yes vote?
Well, I mean, we've seen in the last couple of days the pound has fallen just in response to these polls, showing that independence is more likely. So, you know, I think that is a reflection that capital flight is certainly a possibility. In terms of the economic future of Scotland as an independent country. They have oil, but who knows how long that will last. And that raises real concerns about Scotland going it alone. It can't rely on oil revenue forever. The other real economic concern is, of course, the currency, because the Yes campaigners say they will keep the pound. Well, they can keep the pound if they want. There are countries around the world who use the US dollar, but you know, they don't have any impact on how the Federal Reserve works. So there are real concerns about some kind of currency union. We've seen in the European Union, in the Eurozone in recent years, that currency unions that aren't worked out properly don't tend to have a very good record.
It's worth saying they've always had their own banknotes, even though they're denominated. There's always been that Bank of Scotland banknote that, you know, occasionally washes up in the cash registers south of the border.
And you get a taxi driver in London will look at you very oddly, but legally is required to take your Scottish tender. It's legal tender south of the border. But yeah, you're right. It doesn't make it down there very often.
Fascinating. All right, let's change direction. Nick Harper, you are, as I said, getting ready to cover this United Nations General Assembly meeting, and presumably President Obama's appearance is going to be dominated by what he has to say about Iraq and Syria. How does the land lie at the United Nations, not an institution that has always been especially cooperative with the Obama White House?
No, well, yes, going into this week already, the big talk is about President Obama and his appearance. As per usual, he gets an opportunity to speak, as do all of the member states during the week of speeches. But more importantly, he will be hosting a UN Security Council meeting, a meeting looking at terrorism, looking at peace and security. And really, the real focus will be on the Islamic State, on IS, and the fact that it's been rampaging its way through Iraq and Syria. President Obama very much wants to try and make progress on this. Out of the UN Security Council meeting, he wants a resolution. He wants all of the other member states to agree with him, to approve this resolution. And he really wants to create some sort of strategy to move forward. It'll be interesting to see exactly how strongly worded this resolution is, especially in terms of Syria. The UN Security Council, over the last 3.5 years that the Syrian conflict has been going on, has struggled to make much progress on Syria. The main problem has often been the differences of opinion on the council. On the one side, we've got most of the Western countries, the United Kingdom, the US, with their anti-Syrian government opinions. And on the other side, we've got the Russians, who are really the only ally that the Syrians have left. And because of that, they have been at loggerheads and been unable to achieve very much. President Obama wants this resolution. It seems at this stage as if it shouldn't have too much trouble passing, but that may well mean that they will have to water down some of the wording, in particular to do with the Syrian part of it. I think everyone agrees that the Islamic State is a terrible thing and they'll be happy to go on board with that. But it'll be interesting to see how they deal with the Syrian side.
But he's had terrible trouble, as you said, at the United Nations Security Council dealing with Russia and also with China over the Syria issue. The relationship between the US ambassador, Samantha Power, and the Russian ambassador, Vitaly Churkin, at the United Nations appears to be the coldest of cold relationships imaginable over what's taken place in Ukraine. Is there, you know, Samantha Power herself has previously said the world does not have the Security Council that it deserves. I mean, is there any reason to think that he can make much meaningful headway during the course of the General Assembly week?
Well, yes, we've seen a huge dip in relations, especially over the last 6 months. It seems to have got frostier and frostier by the meeting. They've had more than 20 meetings on Ukraine, for example, and every single time there seems to be fireworks between Samantha Power and Vitaly Churkin on the other side, just having completely different opinions on the matter. I think the hope is, by having a meeting during the UN General Assembly, during a week where we have heads of states from 193 different countries from around the world there, present in New York, and many of the big names there present inside the Security Council chamber, the hope is that there will be more of a spotlight on the meeting. There'll be more pressure to try and get something done, to exert that pressure on some of the countries in the past like China, like Russia, who perhaps haven't been willing to put up their hand and say yes.
And as usual, a whole range of competing issues pushing for attention. Let me ask you about one that clearly requires attention, and that's Ebola. How much is that going to be discussed at this UN Assembly meeting, and what kind of meaningful progress could we look for?
Well, at this stage, there are no obvious high-level meetings organised on Ebola. We're likely to have a whole raft of sideline meetings, and it's likely that it'll be something that'll come up in most of the speeches, especially the African countries who've been involved with this. But the United Nations is really trying to push the message, and they did this last week when we heard from David Nabarro, the UN's head of Ebola, and Margaret Chan, the Director General of the World Health Organization, saying very clearly that Ebola is something that every single country has to take seriously. It is something that every single country is accountable for and responsible for. It's not just down to the African countries who've been affected to deal with this. Every country needs to get a handle of it on it, and they're also warning that it's going to get worse before it gets better. So I think the UN General Assembly will be a time where it will get mentioned a lot. It's just this whole problem, as is so often the case with the United Nations, there's a lot of talking, but will there actually be any meaningful action? Will there be an action plan coming out of the week on how to tackle Ebola?
And is there any talk anymore about reform of the United Nations, particularly the Security Council? It used to be every year you'd attend these meetings and get told that one of the major issues on the agenda was reform of the architecture, and then nothing actually happened. Is there any discussion about that, given that Samantha Power says we don't have the Security Council we deserve?
Undoubtedly, yes. It'll be a big topic for some countries. Some countries will just ignore it. It won't even be something that'll be mentioned. But there are a number of countries out there who feel that they are not well represented in the United Nations and not well represented on the Security Council. In particular, India, Japan, Brazil, South Africa. These are all countries who would like to have a permanent seat at the table on the Security Council. They can get these rotating seats where they sit on the council for 2 years, and after 2 years, then they're off again. They're replaced by somebody else. Those are all countries that would like more influence. They would like more say. But there is a huge amount of politics involved because China has a permanent seat on the Security Council. They're unwilling to let Japan on. So you're not going to get consensus on letting, say, Japan on. But there has been a lot of talk on how to expand the 15-member council, whether it's increased to 20 or perhaps 25 members, so that you have not just more permanent members, but more rotating members. Something that, yes, will surely come up again.
What date does this meeting begin?
So it all starts next Tuesday on the 23rd. We have a whole day of climate change talks, something that the Secretary General feels is very important, so important that we're giving over a whole day to it. And then the speeches themselves start on Wednesday the 24th, run through till the end of next Tuesday.
So, Ollie Barrett, that's 4 or 5 days after the Scottish referendum result is in. Will David Cameron be representing Britain at this United Nations General Assembly?
I think he probably will, but it's going to be close. And, it's going to be much closer than we all thought. And from a selfish point of view as a journalist, that makes it more interesting than I think we thought it might have been just a few weeks ago.
So nip and tuck.
Exactly. It's going to be very close indeed.
Ollie Barrett, you will hear his coverage of the Scottish referendum, September the 18th it takes place, right here on FSN Reports. And you can follow him on Twitter at Ollie Barrett. He'll be heading up to Edinburgh in just a few days. And Nick Harper, you can hear his coverage of the UN General Assembly on this programme. And you can follow Nick on Twitter, where you will find him at Nick Harper FSN. And that is FSN Reports for this Tuesday. I'm Simon Marks. Tomorrow we will return to our more regular diet of news stories from around the world. For everyone with FSN everywhere, thanks for listening. Goodbye from Washington.